Everyone, I'm Ben Groves.
And I'm Rob McFarlane. Welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. Before we get to what we're doing, let's ask the most important question. How are you doing?
I'm buzzing, mate.
Yeah?
Eurovision last night, it was incredible. It's the first one I've watched in 2 decades.
Nice.
I hate myself for not doing it sooner.
Right.
It's incredible.
We normally do watch parties and I totally forgot that it was on this year because I've been nesting.
You
I've
have,
been getting,
mate.
Like magnetic knife racks from my kitchen.
Hate
I've been
this.
Hanging pictures. I'm like, I'm going to make this the flat.
Yeah.
And then my landlord will probably end the tenancy I have 1 week maybe, I reckon, and they'll be like, we're selling.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way it's gone normally.
Let's start the show a little bit. We're going to be talking characters we love to hate.
We're asking, is that symbolism or is that the rule of cool?
And we're talking A24.
And most importantly, we're asking, what does this film really mean?
What does that mean?
Let's get into it.
What does it really mean? Let's get into it. All right. I have written the breakdown. I haven't put it in this yet because I wanted to keep it secret.
That's fine. While you do that, I'll explain to new listeners that we spoil the entire film just for about a minute.
We do.
We go through Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, so everyone knows what we're talking about. Not everyone wants to watch every film, but everyone wants to listen to every episode. So consider this your spoiler warning. And if you've not seen this film yet, go do it. Or if you don't want to watch it, don't.
You start this one. I've written the first and third one for you.
Okay.
I'm going to take the middle one.
Act 1, Mythical Roadkill.
Yeah.
Great band name.
Thank you.
Elliot, a well-meaning but distracted dad, is driving his unenthused teenage daughter Riley to a business meeting in the mountains when bam,
bam,
they accidentally turn a magical baby unicorn into pre-roadkill.
It's not quite roadkill.
No, not yet.
It's roadkill light.
It's a real unicorn.
A real unicorn.
Naturally, they stuff the sparkly corpse into their car like it's just another Tuesday and head to the Leopold's fancy as fuck mountain retreat to try and land himself a job and blag that there isn't a unicorn kicking its way back to life in the courtyard.
Yeah, that's good. See? Act 2, Horns, Hype, and the Cure for Cancer.
Whoop, whoop.
At the billionaire's private estate, things get weird fast, buddy. The unicorn's body starts leaking miracle cures like it's a Pinterest essential oils mood board gone nuclear. Suddenly, this turns into a wellness gold rush.
Wow.
Tech CEOs, government stooges, and PR vultures all want a slice of this magical carcass.
Is that Gwyneth Paltrow?
That's her new line.
Famous magical carcass, yeah. Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah.
Elliot gets swept up in the promises of fame, funding, and eternal youth while Riley watches the adults around her lose their minds and morals faster than you can say unethical bioprospecting.
Did you just put bioprospecting in a sentence that you wrote?
I'm trying hard to use bigger words because I feel like people in the Discord are like,
yeah,
he misspelt the, and it's like, you know what, guys? Fuck yourselves. How about that? How about that? It's like Jurassic Park, but the rich cunts aren't even a little bit likable.
So it's like Jurassic Park 2.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, it's basically a remake of that. Act 3, Glitter Gets Gary. Oh, no way. Glitter Gets Gory.
All right, Glitter Gets Gary is better, to be fair. That is better.
Just when everyone thinks they've cornered the market on immortality, nature pulls a reverse Uno. Oh, that's the wrong way around. Oh, that's meta. Enter the unicorn parents, majestic, furious, and absolutely not here for your capitalist nonsense.
Nonsense!
What follows is a magical creature revenge rampage. Think John Wick, but with hooves and sparkles. People start getting impaled in very poetic ways. Amid the carnage, Riley steps up as the lone voice of reason, and Elliot must choose between being a sellout or, you know, not getting trampled by unicorns. In the end, humanity learns a valuable lesson. We don't own nature.
We do not. It's not ours to sell.
Is that what you took from this?
That I've got something for this.
Okay.
I've got a couple things I've taken from this that I like. And the reason I wanted to cover this film
right.
is because I saw it.
And you thought, this is funny.
I saw it and was like, oh, what a charming little creature feature, weird piece. And then it kind of stuck with me for a couple of days. And I was like, okay. But what if? But what if?
Okay, let's get into it. Let's get into it.
What was your initial reaction?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very fun horror comedy creature feature, sort of in the vein of American Werewolf.
Right.
With some sort of sledgehammery social commentary that lacks a little subtlety.
Okay.
We'll get into that.
Yeah.
You can't hate it. You can't hate it, but you probably won't remember it.
Yeah. I like that you've gone the sledgehammer route, because right. that's interesting, because I very much had the same initial yeah. reaction. I was like, this is, it's very on the surface. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of on the nose. But I feel like it's layered.
Right.
In ways that, I've watched this a couple of times now, obviously, because I'm a fiend.
Yeah.
It's a delicate line that I walk.
It's a delicate line of watching it as many times as possible.
Yeah.
Before you have to start prepping the episode. Yeah. I rate that.
Yeah, thanks,
I rate
man.
That.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think the unicorns at the end?
Right.
What do you think them changing from dark to light represents?
Oh, yeah, because they start off as black unicorns.
Yeah.
And then they end up as white unicorns.
Yeah.
If you try and turn this into some sort of race theory,
No race theory.
Okay, good. Ben, this is not a deep film.
Okay.
It's just the rule of cool.
That's a nice takeaway from it. I'm going to spend the rest of the show giving you some thinking points.
Right.
And then I'm going to drop a fucking knowledge bomb on you, and you're going to go,
what has happened? Are we in a topsy-turvy universe?
Yeah.
You used, what was the word? I can't even remember the word you used.
Bioprospecting.
Multiple syllable words.
Yeah.
There's a bit on the notes here later that says tapestries.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you even know what a tapestry is.
It's a fucking rug.
And now
rug.
You're going to knowledge bomb me.
It's a rug. I had to Google tapestry. It's a rug.
This is...
It's a rug that you put on your fucking wall.
Are the dogs about to start playing poker?
No.
Okay, because...
I'm not into that art, Rob. I like stuff that hits my soul.
Oh, fuck off.
So this is Schaffman.
Is the director called... I know nothing about this film, Ben. You
Schaffman.
Said just watch the film.
Yeah.
I'm in a bizarre state where I've turned up to a podcast and I know nothing.
Okay.
The director's called Schaffman.
Alex Schaffman.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Alex Schaffman.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, Alex. I'm sure you're a very...
Avid listener. He's an avid fan.
Well, not anymore.
This is his first film. He's been a producer for many, many years, worked on a few films. He's written a bunch of films, like 12... feature films,
right.
None of which have been made.
I was going to say, it's his first feature. He's worked on 12 films.
Yeah. No. He's produced Shedloads.
All right, okay.
He's produced Shedloads. He's written 12 scripts, but I don't think any of them have made it through the rigorous process.
Right. So, sorry, a film about unicorns as a metaphor for communism... Well, not communism.
Communism.
A film.
You hit the unicorn with a car and it just goes, da, brother.
Basically. It's basically what it does.
Give me your shoes. Your shoes are my shoes.
It's just unicorns calling everyone capitalist pigs.
And
that got made. So I want to see what the 12 that did were considered too zany.
I don't know. So I feel like...
Just like his first film is just 2 hours of Jim Carrey getting a colonoscopy.
I'd watch that. Yeah, exactly.
That's why it's not that. They would have made that.
That's the number 24.
Oh.
Get it?
Yeah, it's a 24.
Good stuff. So Alex Schaffman wrote this film and was like, maybe this is one of the scripts that I don't pass on to get made by someone else. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is one that I look at making myself because I can really put the love and effort it deserves into it. And I'm glad he did.
Right.
Because it came out exactly as he wanted.
Okay.
He'd been a producer for many years, so he knew the process inside and out. He knew how difficult it was going to be. He was under no illusions that this was going to be an easy ride. So everyone that went into this film to make it, fully equipped, fully prepared, fully ready for the entire thing. So when things did get difficult, it wasn't like, what are we going to do? It's an absolute nightmare. They just got it done.
Okay.
He just got it done for the betterment of everyone. Yeah, he just Finchered it. He wrote this.
This reminds me of a David Fincher film in almost no ways.
Exactly. That's what makes it so special, Rob. So he wrote this film a while ago. He had an idea for this a while ago. It was Death of a Something. It wasn't a unicorn, but it was Death of a Something. He had this concept for a script a while ago.
Had he recently read Death of a Salesman?
It might have been Death of a Salesman.
How capitalism
is. Had he read the film?
Well, it's a play originally, and
then
it turned into a film.
Got you.
With Dustin Hoffman before Dustin Hoffman died in that hideous molestation accident.
Sure.
So it's a film essentially about this, just minus a unicorn.
The Hoffman accident.
Yeah, the Dustin
molestation accident.
Yeah.
He just fell into it.
Yeah. I mean, he died. His career died, Ben.
Yeah.
You've got to take this seriously, okay?
Yeah, my bad.
Yeah.
Just like how Kevin Spacey accidentally fell into them 14-year-old boys. Yeah, that's bad.
They're not listening. Kevin Spacey is.
Oh, he's another avid listener.
He
keeps sending me texts. K-Pax, dickhead. Do K-Pax. I'm like, mate, I can't watch that anymore because you're in it.
Of texts and you were to in that boy. From Kevin Spacey, that's mild.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Did you say you were in that boy? Oh, it's gone horribly wrong.
This is
Schaffman.
Great. Schaffman.
Yes.
Wrote this film a while ago. Wrote the concept of it a while ago. Sort of did work on it throughout various periods of his life in between writing other scripts. Yeah. His good friend, Paul Rudd.
Oh, just casual.
Casual. Paul Rudd, you know, Ant-Man. Huge, lovable. Ghostbusters. He's huge. Mm. Everyone knows him. Everyone loves him.
Yeah.
It's just good mates with Alex Schaffman. They were just hanging out the one day and Paul Rudd casually asks Alex, hey, bud, do you ever write parts with people in mind?
Mm.
And what? This is all conjecture, by the way. I wasn't there for this.
Right, okay.
I just left the room.
Right, okay. I don't know,
fucking phone call from Spacey again. In my mind, yeah. Alex sits there and goes, well, that's a very interesting question that you've just asked me there, Paul Rudd.
Star of Ant-Man. Do I write for people? I wonder what this could be about.
I might write for people. Why? Yeah. What did you have in mind?
He said yes and then went home and got the typewriter down from the attic, didn't he?
In my mind, you heard his dick hit the table and then he left the room immediately to begin writing for Paul Rudd. I would have done the same thing. This is insane. This is Alex Schaffman on getting Paul Rudd to do this film. I wrote the lead role for Paul. I'd met him years ago. About a script that I wasn't set to direct, and he asked me if I ever write for specific actors, which I took as a hint, and yeah, I got very lucky.
Could you do it again? But I don't know which version I want to use, so we'll keep that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd like to hear you do it in Alex Schaffman's voice.
I don't know. He's like a New Yorker. I can't
do New
York.
No, he's called Alex Schaffman.
So in your mind, Alex Schaffman is like a Berlin club promoter.
He's a Berlin techno promoter, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah. I wrote this lead role for Paul. I'd met him years ago.
Why is he Werner Herzog?
About a script that I wasn't set to direct, but he asked me if I ever write for specific actors, which I took as a hint, and yeah, I got very lucky.
There we go.
If there are any animation companies out there that are looking for...
German Jar Jar.
That's it. Sign me the fuck up immediately.
The Rike of Skywalker.
Fuck's sake.
I've milked it.
Guess
dry
who
now.
Comes back in episode 9? It ain't Palpatine. He's just been hiding on the moon. Fucking hell. Right, I'm back on. The writing of this film.
Yes.
I found it to be ridiculous. Mm. Because my first note on this is extremely simple, straightforward, yet incredibly effective writing sets us up for this entire universe within minutes of this film starting. You know everything that you need to know about this entire universe from one car ride.
Yes.
And a very casual conversation about losing signal in the mountains.
It's a little exposition heavy, but it's done quite naturally.
Exactly.
And I think it's that thing of... There's no point as Paul Rudd turned to, hello, my estranged daughter. How are you dealing with the death of our white mother?
This is why I love it so much, because by the time that we're in the car with Paul and Jenna, which I've ignored there.
No one listening to this knows their character names.
It's Elliot and Ridley.
Yeah, fine.
We know that the relationship between these two, we know it's a little bit strained. We know the dynamic of this relationship, and we know that these guys are doing this whilst trying to keep themselves together in these pristine mountains, untouched by man.
Mm.
Untouched by man is a key component for this entire fucking film.
Right, okay.
And it's so casually just like, bah, bah. Also, your mom's dead. How do you feel about that? Do you know what I mean? There's that whole thing going on. But it's so soft and subtle and delicate. Mm. There's no sort of like slapping you in the face with sort of big,
points. I wonder if what you're doing... Because you're a big B-movie head. You watch a lot of B-movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you've kind of internalized B-movie dialogue and B-movie script writing. Did you approach this as a B-movie and were then surprised that the writing was competent?
No, I approached this as an indie movie and was surprised that it was a B-movie that had a budget.
Okay, fair. I kind of feel like... praising the writing for being competent.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I'm wondering, is that a B-movie thing where you were keyed for like, this is going to be a trauma film, and then you were like, oh wow, it's actually well written.
All right. Well, in the realm of it's about unicorns.
Yeah, exactly.
I was very...
It was a pleasant
It was a massive
shock.
Yeah, but then also, outside of that realm, I was like, just on a filmmaking basis, regardless of whether it's about fucking unicorns or anything else that's happening in this universe... It's just an incredible bit of writing that caught me so off guard. And I'm like, I'm in.
Fair.
This whole universe makes sense to me immediately.
Yep.
I can relax into the film. it's rare that that happens these days. Normally you sort of, you fed it bit by bit and it's sort of,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Depending on the films you're watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of my stuff is slow build.
A lot of the stuff you watch is like The Gorge.
That's immediate. You're in immediately.
If you're coming from The Gorge to this, I can see why you'd be like, oh, how well crafted.
I love The Gorge. I think The Gorge is a mint film.
It's fucking awful.
Man. We're going to get into The Gorge soon, buddy. I'm bringing that to the table. I've got a trilogy cooking, all right? Oh, I've got a trilogy cooking.
Okay.
Sorry, listeners, you could not see his face, but that was fucking precious. When was the last time you watched a film where you were coded to hate every character? Even the good people, they were written in a way where you were supposed to feel negatively towards them at various points throughout the film.
That's one of those questions where if you'd given it me a couple of days ago and I'd had a proper think,
yeah,
I'd probably be able to find an answer.
Yeah, yeah.
But off the top of my head,
okay,
I'm not like, oh, it's really common. Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, maybe Downfall. But Downfall. Besides that, yeah, I couldn't off the top of my head. You're right. Okay. It's an interesting thing that
it's a
everyone
rarity.
In this is hateable.
Right.
You could say, well, the general Taker character, you know, she's fighting for nature, this kind of thing. She's so privileged.
Oh, yeah,
and she's 1,000%. So self-centered. The film enters with her being a sort of moody, resentful teenager, which is only getting weirder as she gets older.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, is she supposed to be a moody, resentful 25-year-old?
Yeah, I know.
Because you should be over this now at this point in your development. Her dad has got this incredible career opportunity to become the lawyer in charge of this family estate.
Of a pharmaceutical company. Yeah.
And the pharmaceutical company have said, come with us to our mountain retreat so we can get to know your family and understand that we can trust you on a personal level. Mm. And the moody she throws about being driven to a mountain paradise
in a Jaguar,
hang out with millionaires in a Jaguar.
Yeah.
Just being like, yeah, fine, I'll play along with you, but that's it.
Yeah.
Fuck off. He's also lost his wife, you selfish bitch. like everyone in this is detestable.
Fuck grieving for your mom. I've lost my wife, Rob McFarlane.
No, I'm just saying everybody's in pain and he's very clearly trying and you're rolling your eyes.
Yeah.
And the luxury to have a parent that tries and then you roll your eyes at it.
Yeah.
Would you like to see the alternative?
That's exactly it. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I trying to get a new job that's going to earn us millions?
For you.
So that you don't have to pay your student debts or ever worry about money ever again.
And you can study your art history without consequence. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, what do you mean you're going to drop me at the airport and then come back to finish off the job interview? Bitch, listen to the pitch.
Everyone sucks here.
Yeah,
everyone
you've also got the Leopolds. Here. Each of the Leopolds. The Leopolds are an interesting one for me.
So the rich family who they're
visiting. Family.
Yeah, the
pharmaceutical The rich family
heads.
Are great because they are expected to be these sort of like over-the-top, cartoonish, evil caricature people, right?
And they are.
To an extent.
Yeah.
At the beginning, they're just wealthy people who are a little misguided and you're like, oh, they've lost touch with reality bit. Or they don't understand a poorer person's reality because they're so far removed from it, which is fine. Mm-hmm. And it's done in a sort of like a quite a subtle way.
Yeah.
And then they realize that obviously there's a unicorn
in
Elliot's car.
Cancer,
It starts curing all these like illnesses and stuff. Oh my, Ridley's acne on her face has cleared up. Oh, my eyes suddenly work and I don't need glasses anymore. So Leopold's like, well, I've got cancer, so fill me with the blood immediately.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. But whilst all this is going on, everyone is sort of delving into these weird, weird hovels, like shadows of themselves where everything is amplified. Like Will Poulter becomes this way over the top, like rich boy.
I adore him in this film.
He's my favorite person on the planet by a long shot. I fucking love him. He starts off with, you know, Griff, the butler.
Yeah.
And every now and then he's like, oh, Griff, if you wouldn't mind just doing this.
Yeah.
And then the second that sort of like the cancer treatment seems to be working, if he needs a pencil sharpening, Griff!
He's shouting from across the other side of the house.
It's fucking amazing.
That, like, on the other side of the room.
Elliot, do you want some swimming trunks? Griff! Oh, you don't want them? Griff! It's fucking amazing.
Everyone
just turns insane.
They become an amplified version. And I think I agree with you that when it starts off, there's complexity with the Leopolds and they're kind of, yes, they are out of touch and they are very clearly kind of spoiled and living a life of comfort that has ruined them as people. As everything becomes amplified, what happens is you lose any subtlety.
You do.
In the kind of eat the rich metaphor, you have the Paul Rudd character, who is the working class man who is trying to work with them to get what he needs.
He's a lawyer for a pharmaceutical company.
No, but in terms
company.
Of the metaphor, they are the ultra rich. Yeah, they're the bourgeoisie.
Yeah.
And you have his
daughter.
Did you
just say bourgeoisie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, because we're talking about communism. And that's their favorite word.
No, right? No, I got you.
So they're like the aristocrats. They're the bourgeoisie, right? Okay, everyone's going to just look you dead in the eye every time I say it.
I like it.
You've got the General Taker character, who's the working kind of like, no, we're going to smash the system.
Mm.
And Paul Rudd's in the middle going, that's a lovely idea, but I'm a bit older and I've realized you can't. The best you can try and do is work within it.
Mm-hmm.
That is a nice setup, but it's painted with the broadest strokes possible. When you've got Richard E. Grant with a semi-automatic rifle talking about all of the endangered animals he's gunned down, you're like, oh, okay, we're just...
Hold on, because that moment where he's like, the natives in Africa would hunt down these animals with nothing but spears, and then pulls up an enormous rifle. But of course, I killed them all with a semi-automatic rifle.
Right.
It's fucking gorgeous.
It is, but it's also the first joke you'd write. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
No one's gone, oh, and then what? Like, what's the other joke? So it's kind of at that sort of like pub banter level of comedy, rather than...
I'll agree. I'm with you 100%.
Rather than like any sort of insightful cleverness.
Yes.
What's the broadest stroke I can take? Jam it together.
100%.
That's the film.
I think that's on purpose.
Okay.
I think the Leopolds are that. I think they're supposed to be that end,
stereotype,
that spectrum.
2D.
And you've got the sort of audience surrogate, the working man, as
and
we're going to call
Ortega,
him.
Yeah, yeah.
And like General Ortega and Paul Rudd. You've got those guys who are genuinely being funny at the awful situations that are presented to him, because that's what we can relate to as an audience.
Yeah.
When we're working for the man
and we're
put in awful situations and they crack the shit pub quiz level jokes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
This is why watching the film again, like the second or third time through, I really started to crush on Alex Shoffman's writing, because I was just sort of like, I didn't think this film would have rewatchability.
Mm-hmm.
It 1,000% does.
Right.
The deeper you go and the more you think about it, it just gives you, it doesn't explain anything. It just gives you diving off points. And sort of little tidbits of going, isn't this a weird thing? Isn't this pretty funny?
Yeah.
And then as the film goes on, these get a little deeper and a little bigger, and the points get a little wider.
I think it goes the other way. Here's our setup. You've got the ultra rich.
Yeah.
You've got the person who's trying to work with them to get what they need, and the person who has no interest in working with them and wants the system smashed.
Right.
Which is a really nice cross-section of society, right? You then have the inciting incident, which is the killing of a unicorn.
Yeah.
And then how does everyone react to that? There's a whole scope of complexity there.
There is.
And there's a lot of potential. And it didn't feel like it got subtler and more interesting. It felt like it got broader and less interesting as it went on.
Oh, okay.
It felt like it went down the expected broad brush route.
Okay.
It would be more interesting if they were actually good people and they were going...
That'd be good.
What kind of world do you live in where you think the life of this one unicorn...
Yeah.
is worth the lives of everyone suffering with cancer from which your mother died, which is briefly mentioned.
Yeah.
That's not presented as a moral dilemma. It's presented as a flawed argument by them to try and manipulate her rather than really engaging with her. That is a genuinely interesting debate that's not had. It's just presented as a bad faith argument and then moved on from.
It is.
So it gets narrower as time goes on and becomes rich bad, poor good, system needs smashing.
Yeah.
That's what you should do, viewer.
Okay.
It's very easy to say smash the system from a laptop that you bought that was made by a child.
Yeah. Out of materials mined in countries you'll never visit.
By children.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So smashing the system in reality means go live in a tent and live off stuff you pick off trees.
Hmm.
But that's not an answer. And I feel like the film doesn't get into that. It just goes rich bad, poor good, end. I'm in sympathy, and that is my politics.
Yeah.
I think rich bad, poor good.
Yeah, yeah.
I just feel like this doesn't really offer anything besides that statement.
I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly. I fully appreciate it. The thing that differed for me is Paul Rudd, Elliot's character, was a sliding scale between the two.
He moved back.
You got to view, depending on what situation he's in at that moment, and his focus from short term to long term, like small goal to big goal, was shifting constantly. And you had rich bad pulling in one way.
And his arc is he starts as one and ends as the other.
Kind of, but it's he flits between the two, don't you think?
For me, it was he starts saying, look, this is the world we live in.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to compromise.
Okay.
And I'm trying to compromise. You've got your principles. That's lovely. Yeah. I had them too, but I've lived in the world. It's a dangerous place.
Can't afford to have them.
People die all the time.
Yeah.
I can't afford to have them.
Yeah.
I'm going to compromise mine to allow you the freedom to maintain yours. You get to study art history. And by the end of it, she goes, I would rather live devastated with an uncompromised father than live comfortably in a world where the only parent I have who I love is a turncoat.
I like this. I think Paul Rudd's sort of unwavering commitment.
There we go.
Unwavering
commitment. What is happening, Ben?
To his dead wife's
promise. Have you got a dictionary under your pillow? Are you putting audiobooks
on? I've barely got a dick under the pillow, mate. I have a pillow on my lap. That's the joke, dear listener. All right, enjoy that.
Paul Rudd's unwavering commitment.
Unwavering commitment to a promise that he made to his dying wife where he would look after his child. It corrupts his morals to a point where he doesn't necessarily align with the life that he's living, but he feels the need to be doing this to give what he said that he would give to his daughter before his wife passed. And it's this sort of laser focus that is affecting the current family dynamic. It's affecting his actual daughter's life right now. But the only thing that he's thinking about early on in the film is, in the end, it's going to be golden. It'll all be worth it. I'll pay for the therapy. I'll do what I need to do. This is fine. I will get it done. And I've been in that position before.
Yeah.
Where I've ran myself into the ground for no reason.
Yeah. And you take an overdraft out against your future wellness.
Yeah, 1,000%.
Yeah,
and I've done that time and time and time again. So that bit kind of cut me up. And there's very delicate conversations that are just seemingly throwaway. Have you eaten yet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Griff bought me a sandwich. There's stuff like this that kind of pull him back into the moment where he's like, fuck. And you see this little, he's such a fucking good actor. It's so annoying. He has these really delicate internal debates while still being hilarious. Yeah. And there's just basic comedy playing out on the screen, but it is so lovingly written and so well crafted that it cuts me up every time.
I didn't for me, but okay. I see it. I think it's there. I think it's in pencil.
It is. I'll agree.
I think if you've got the right jigsaw piece to slot into that,
you'll
see a kaleidoscope of stuff that I didn't.
100%.
Because I don't have that jigsaw piece.
That's understandable. Right? It's different strokes for different folks. Exactly. That's all it is.
Yeah, it's that.
I've got a little bit here that I've done a lot of research into.
No, Ben, this is going to be one of those moments where you've taken something that's in the film for four frames and done an 8-hour, 10-hour research project.
No. It's in the film for 7 minutes. Okay. But it's talked about a lot.
Oh, is this the tapestries?
Yeah. This is a true story. It's a true Death of a Unicorn is a true made up story.
How?
Unicorn tapestries. Wall rugs.
Yes.
In the late 16th century, the 7 of them.
Yes.
Depicting an entire cycle of discovering unicorn, capturing unicorn.
Wait, those are real?
They live in the Cloisters Museum in New York City.
What?
This film is based on all 7 of them.
No, it isn't.
It's incredible, dude. So I had to Google what a tapestry was. I had to Google what a tapestry was, right? And I was not disappointed. Cloisters Museum in New York.
Right.
There are these works of art called the Unicorn Tapestries.
Funny that.
7 tapestries.
Right.
Made up by an unknown artist.
Okay.
In the 16th century, late 15th, early 16th century.
Is that because they downloaded them off Napster, so that metadata's gone?
Can't find that shit anymore. No one screenshot it.
No one screenshot it.
Dickheads. They lived in an aristocratic Parisian home until they were nearly destroyed in the French Revolution.
Yeah.
They were recovered, but one of them was all fucked up.
Right.
So this is good. But because it's an unknown artist and because it was so long ago, the artist's name's been lost to time.
You can use it.
Use it in whatever film you want to make.
Use it on your YouTube videos, mate.
That's it. Chuck them in there. No, who's going to stop you? Ghosts? So these unicorn tapestries, museum in New York, late 16th century. There is 7 of them. But because the names of the artist has been lost to time, the correct order has also been lost to time. No one knows the exact order that these tapestries are supposed to be in, so they don't know whether, you know, the first one is panel one or panel seven.
Fine.
But there is an agreed upon sort of staging of the Fine. Tapestries that, that tend to make sense, and people have interpreted a story from these.
Okay.
So what I've done is I've made a little list of the seven tapestries and how it correlates to the film.
Okay.
I've put in some work, bud.
Oh my God.
Are we ready for this? So the first tapestry is called The Hunters Enter the Woods. And I can...
That's easy. That's them driving into the into the woods. It's the drive-in where you get the backstory about the dead mum.
It's the beginning of the unicorn hunts. The humans intrude upon the unicorn's habitat, right? Untouched natural space is what the website said about these tapestries. And I'm like, untouched by man, is it? Untouched by man. The second one is The Unicorn Purifies Water. So the meaning behind this one is the unicorn cleanses a poisoned stream representing purity and healing. So this is where the unicorn's body at the Leopold's mansion is discovered to have healing properties.
Yeah.
See, it has these miraculous healing properties. It illustrates the idea of the unicorn as like a healing object, like force, presence.
Right.
You know what I mean? The third one, the unicorn crosses a stream. Now, this is an interesting one.
Because it does not in the film.
It is.
No, it isn't.
It is, but it isn't. The unicorn crosses a stream. It's a transitional moment. So it's representing a threshold between wild and civilized realms. This is what the tapestry meaning says. What I took from that in the film is the story goes from the accident to a deliberate action. So it goes from accidentally hitting a baby unicorn to deliberately exploiting its meat, blood, horn.
Yeah, okay. So it gets in the house. They bring it in the house.
There's another threshold. It's not a vampire, Rob, all right?
They just bring it across the threshold of the door into a lab.
All right, well, I went for the moral boundary. You went for vampires.
This is backwards.
Can't
come in. Why are you doing subtext? I hate this.
The fourth tapestry is the unicorn defends itself. We know this. Unicorn fights back against the hunters, and it represents nature's resistance. This is what the tapestry is.
Right, okay, nice.
So the film correlation, obviously, the arrival of the vengeful parents. They start running around, disemboweling people, just fucking annihilating everyone. And it shows nature pushing back against the human arrogance and commodification of their baby.
This is...
Subtext, baby.
Commodification.
Yeah.
Okay, yep.
This is what happens when a B-movie gets a budget.
Right.
I get erect and I research for 2 weeks.
All it takes is a B-movie with a budget and one mean comment on the Discord and you're like, right.
Watch me fucking use a word, dickhead. Come at me, bro.
Right.
Fifth tapestry, the unicorn surrenders to a maiden. So a virgin tames a unicorn, often seen as symbolic of Christ surrendering to Virgin Mary.
That's explicitly not only stated, not only seen in the film, but it's stated as a parallel.
Yes, it is,
because
that's a key moment that obviously it's difficult to subtext that.
Yeah.
So they had to just go, Jenna Ortega.
Yeah.
Right.
So what if a unicorn just knelt in front of Jenna Ortega and everyone saw it and went, oh, it's because it's emblematic of Christ surrender. Yep.
Yeah, there's that. The sixth tapestry.
Yep.
The hunters return to the castle. So the captured unicorn is brought back in triumph.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is after it's been shot again.
Literal, yeah.
And then it's been brought back. I think this is the part outside where Will Poulter has the baby unicorn and Paul Rudd and Will Poulter have the standoff.
He's the hunter, yeah.
Seventh one, unicorn in captivity. So the tapestry meaning the unicorn is alive, it's enclosed in a garden, and it's seemingly at peace, but trapped. So it's symbolizing the paradox of beauty under control. So the final phase is mirrored in the unicorn's magic is still continuing to be exploited after its death.
Mm-hmm.
So it is trapped. It's seemingly at peace, but it is the whole paradox of, is it alive and well and thriving? Is it doing it? Is it living its best life? No, it's fucking being carted about on a table, cut up to bits.
Yeah.
Regularly being bled from the neck.
So capitalism then?
Yes, exactly what it is. But this whole thing is all the morality has gone out of the window. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that remains is the commercial interests.
Yes.
And I fucking love that at some point, Alex Schaffman went on a school trip to the Cloisters Museum in New York and saw these tapestries on a wall depicting a story of a unicorn.
Yep.
Doing its whole thing and was like, that's all right. Forgot it existed, and then one day remembered it and went, That's my movie.
It explains to me why he made it a B movie.
Okay.
Because if he'd made it as a legitimate A movie, mm-hmm. and it had been up for the Oscar, it would have been outed because it would have only been valid for best adapted screenplay. Because now you've gone through the Unicorn Tapestries.
Oh, yeah.
It's the film.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's Death of a Salesman and the Unicorn Tapestries stitched together. And you say he wrote it, but he hasn't. He's adapted two things into
one. We could write that. We could write the Death of the Unicorn Tapestries film set. We open on the French Revolution. An aristocratic Parisian home.
Right.
Decored walls, as far as the eye can see. Some little knobhead who's been hiding apples out in a field steals the tapestries,
right,
runs away with them, and then we explore what could have happened to these tapestries on their journey. We can put anything in there. Fucking monsters. Crocodiles.
No, because the thing is,
what else
is that,
lives in France?
That would be more of an original story than you have revealed this film to be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
This film, he didn't write this. He just went that and that together.
True made up story.
Okay.
Based on real made up events.
Yeah. It's an adapted screenplay.
But kinda.
Just taking a 15th century kinda. Tapestry and a play from the 50s.
Kinda.
Yeah, fair. But I was surprised. I think this might be A24's stupidest movie.
Oh, buddy.
Well, I would say that, except for Tusk.
I mean, we need to tread carefully because you need to recategorize what you mean by that.
If I give you a plot synopsis of an A24 film,
mm-hmm.
in fact, I'm going to later. I've got a game written and that's the game.
Fucking love it.
You have to guess whether it's A24 or I've made it up.
I love it.
But A24 film like Lady Bird or Moonlight or Everything Everywhere All at Once. Imagine going into A24 and going, I've got a film.
Mm-hmm.
What's the elevator pitch?
Mm.
Of the stupidest sounding films, I think it goes Tusk and then this. Because Tusk is a man gets turned into a walrus.
Yeah.
Against his will. Right.
Well,
they're
yeah.
like, oh, is it like a Franz Kafka? He won't cook one day. No, it's just a B torture porn movie,
mm-hmm.
but it's a walrus.
And Michael Parks. Yeah.
God rest his soul. That's a stupid premise. And it's fun for it. It's good for it.
It's great for
it. The stupider it is, the better.
Yeah.
I think Death of the Unicorn might take the number two slot.
Okay.
What is it? It's a film about a man who kills a unicorn in a hit and run, and then the parents come back and exact revenge.
Is it, though? Is it, though? I mean, on the surface, it is very much that.
Yeah.
But is it, though?
It is. It's that with a little bit of anti-capitalism thrown in as a sprinkling on top.
Okay. Well, I mean, I feel like A24 at the moment just don't miss. A24 have literally, out of nowhere, unironically become one of my... I'm like a fanboy for a film distributor.
Ooh.
At the moment, I've done a bit of research into A24.
Okay.
I'm going to paint a picture for you
as
to what they are and why their films are the way they are, right?
And do we know it's A24? It's not A24.
It's A24.
And 24.
And not 24.
Ah, 24.
That could work.
Could be that. I'd love it if it
that
was
might
that.
Be that.
Welcome to 24 every time you walk in.
I'm going
to
edit that into an A24 title card and just have that snippet forever, live forever. That'll just go into Discord.
24.
Yeah, no context, just straight into thing.
you want to do a couple of other distributors first.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, you know, and then just come up, 24.
Yeah, perfect.
Hopefully, what I've done now
is done
is
enough
rent,
that there's
rent
a good
free.
Take in there.
Yeah, there's a good take, but also that it will live rent-free in a few listeners' mind every time they watch an A24 film.
They better do. A24 have only been around for 12 years, right? They've only been producing movies for six.
Mm-hmm.
So for 6 years, they were just distributors. They would buy rights to a film, put it out and go, that's an A24 film. That's an A24 film.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm on board. And then 6 years, they've been producing movies, right? They differ to other production houses in the way that they operate because A24's focus is on artistic endeavors. It's not about, is it going to make us a milli? Is it going to make us 100 mil at the box office? Is this the next blockbuster? Can we make a franchise out of it? Is it going to sell to everyone? What they do is they take unique artistic voices and they normally run it through a process of going, has this been done before? Will it make an impact? Does it say something that needs to be talked about?
Okay.
And I fucking love that is their ethos. And then they go a few steps further than this. So that's their ethos for putting a film out, right?
I hear that ethos. Yeah. And one of the things that I resent most of all is, I call it the Radiohead attitude, right?
Okay.
And I feel like A24 have got the Radiohead attitude based on what you said there.
Yeah.
Every fucking band that came through the door of where I worked was like, oh, we're going to be like Radiohead. We're going to just create, we're just going to do what we want.
Yeah.
It's going to be about the art. It's not going to be about the money.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great.
But they wanted it to sound like...
You need the money to be able to do that.
Yeah, 100%.
Radiohead can be Radiohead.
100%.
Because they had Creep in the 90s.
Yeah.
Make them enough money that everything else became a side quest.
Yeah, 100%. Right?
So they have the luxury of doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
If you've had your Everything Everywhere All at Once, if you've had your Moonlight, you can sit there and go, I only do things that are of artistic merit. Fucker, we all want to do that, but we're Paul Rudd. It's all very well being Richard E. Grant Leopold going, I'm just sat here just doing things that are artistically... Everyone wants to do that. Every filmmaker wants to be an artist.
If only A24 hadn't been set up by three people that were working for other film distributors, hated the model, and were like, we can do this better.
Yeah.
And then so they lived it, and then were like, we can do this better. They had their Pablo Honeys. They had their OK Computers, and they were like, fuck them off. I don't want to do that anymore. I want to hear some shit that we're not listening. I want the B-sides.
Here's Kid A24.
Yeah. That's it. There you go.
That was fucking mint.
That was good. That was really good.
I'm proud of myself.
I'm a little bit.
Kid.
Killed it. Yeah, that killed it. But so the exact scenario you've just painted out, they were Paul Rudd.
Okay.
They were the Paul Rudds. Then they set up their own thing and were like, we want the stuff that people aren't going to be making. We want the great stories that have been turned down because they're deemed not profitable enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is incredible. And the fact that in 12 years, A24 has 76 Academy Award nominations and 21 wins under its belt.
90% of those are from one film called Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Not 90%. There's a lot of them. So last year it was 55 nominations and 15 wins.
Right, okay.
16 wins.
Might be.
So it's gone up a
I know Everything
shitload
Everywhere
this
All
year.
At Once is the most awarded film in cinematic history.
A24, mate. Yeah, that's what I mean. These guys focus on original auteur-driven stories.
Auteur.
So they prioritize the bold, original storytelling. It's all gone to shit. I've used up all my syllables.
There you go. It was good. See, the thing is, Ben, about being eloquent is it's a stamina game.
You've just yelled about how A24 is like for edgelords, and then I've told you the exact
Ben, my
that you were
petal.
Saying that they that you
my
wish they
petal,
were.
All right, it's called the Radiohead theory. Right? It's called the Radiohead theory. And the thing about Radiohead is that they did it for album after album after album.
Right.
You've had your Pablo Honey.
Right.
But now I've
lived my Pablo Honey, and I'm going to sack off that, and I'm going to go down my independent
route
now. You've
become Snow Patrol. You bust too soon.
You call me Snow Patrol again, I'll end this podcast quicker than we can fucking finish this episode. Snow Patrol.
That's all right, mate.
You're Ice Nine Kills.
I hate you.
You're that edgelord at the back of the room that's like... Yeah, it's good, but I don't like it because I'm cooler than that.
Ice Nine Kills aren't good, and I don't like it.
That's what you get for calling me Snow Patrol, you fair. Bitch. They focus on auteur stories. They do shitloads of risk-taking. They don't care about genre. They can blend it all together. I mean, look at this one, man. Comedy, horror.
It's three things in a
creature
bag.
Feature. It's insane. Yeah. They do... The whole philosophy is like talent first. So it backs directors and writing...
24.
It backs directors and writers with like a distinct style that just aren't fucking anywhere and everywhere. They're like, you're going to stand out. Here's a shitload of money. Make your B-movie with a fucking 100 milli. Off you go. See you later, son. The thing that I like most about them and the thing that gets me most excited when I see the A24 logo, they don't interfere. It's complete artistic control.
Right.
If they believe in you, they don't interfere at all, but they will help you every single step of the way from writing to putting you in touch with the actors you want to work with. They set everything up for you. It's essentially someone going, which way do you want the road to go? And then they build the road as you're walking it without going, oh, stop a sec. Do you want to maybe hold up on this idea? Do you want to maybe do this instead? It's nah. Where are you going? This way. All right, fucking build it.
I feel like their reputation, though, is very much based on like survivor bias, though, in that when I was writing the quiz for later about like, you know, is this a made up film or an A24 film?
Got you.
There's an awful lot of A24 films. that no one has ever heard of that have lost all of their budget.
100%.
And it's I think what they kind of operate on is that 10%, it's the same with a lot of music industry labels. 10% of the artists make all the money.
100%.
The other 90% lose
yeah.
all the money. And there's a razor-thin margin that there allows is. Them to keep borrowing.
Yeah, yeah.
To keep rolling that dice.
But as I said, A24 just don't miss, man.
I mean, this one's fine, you know.
I've got a question for you, though.
Right.
It's going to wrap up.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's going to wrap up my whole ethos for this movie. It's going to wrap up my entire takeaway in one thing. Right. What do you think the unicorns changing from dark to light represents?
It's just cool, man. It's okay.
What does it really mean, Rob?
What does it really mean?
What does death of a unicorn really mean?
I think Alex Scharfengraber mm-hmm. is
yeah.
a closet racist.
And, fucking hell.
And it's only, he saw that the white unicorns were going to have to do violence. And he was like, nope. They're black now. They're black unicorns from an urban area.
The white unicorns do violence. They're the ones that actively fight the police.
Yeah, okay, that's a good point. They would be black if they were fighting the police, and he was a closet racist. So
I mean,
right.
Coming from a closet racist, by the sounds of it. Yeah, would just, they, Rob? Why would they? Why would they be black, Rob?
Because I know the enemy, and I know what they believe. I know what those racist fucks believe.
We're so easy to get cancelled. Just listen to one episode and go, yeah. Done.
No, I'm coming from the right place.
Got you.
Understanding the idiocy of racists is not hey, the same I got as
you.
Being racist.
I got you. Kind of.
Don't.
Kind of.
Well, okay. So what does it really mean? What does it really mean? Because for me, this film is, I'll get to it in my wrap up, but it's a fine film.
Okay.
I don't see much in terms of like, deep subtext, and I'm assuming it's to do with the color changing unicorns. Is it merch reasons? Is it when you get them wet?
No.
It's not like a temperature thing. You put them in the microwave.
Absolutely not. Unicorn. It's a. My whole takeaway of this film is that people are fucking cancer. We are an absolute disease.
Right.
We are the worst thing on this planet.
Yeah.
By a fucking mile.
Okay.
And the unicorns are a visual representation of Mother Earth.
Right.
And how abusive we are towards her, right? So the Leopolds, perfect representation of how we manipulate and justify our fucking awful
yes.
destructive behavior in order for our own personal greed and profits and all this bullshit. It is the dark unicorns
right.
are the abused, taking a shitload of damage. It's the imprint of the humans. The impact of the humans is very visible. It's
right.
it's damage, right? It's done. And then when the unicorns are healing at the end, they're healing their baby, they're healing Elliot, bringing Elliot back to life as well.
Right.
The hate and the damage is leaving the unicorns. They're letting it go, but it's a visual representation as
yeah,
well.
They stand in the light of day.
As when good people stand up
yeah.
and stop fucking abusing nature for their own personal causes,
yeah.
their own personal gain,
yeah.
they start to heal.
Okay.
The damage starts to leave them.
Okay.
Mother Nature can fix herself if we just leave her the fuck alone. Stop trying to gut it for personal profit constantly.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. Okay. I think this whole film is lovingly layered. It's a variety of themes, all woven intricately
okay.
into the tapestry of this film.
Oh, God.
Get it?
Yeah, I do.
Hitting universal points around family dynamics, consumerism, the fucking evil shit that we do to the environment,
mm-hmm.
and how if we just left it alone for a few years, shit would start to heal.
Okay.
I love this.
And
that's one point.
Okay.
Another idea that I had on it is that that it represents vengeance and hate and sort of the mission that these parental unicorns are on. They're on a massive vendetta.
Yeah.
To avenge their murdered child, their murdered butchered child.
Yeah, okay.
So they're like raging around. When they have their child and they have the pure innocence of like the maiden who has helped calm them down and settle them down.
Fair.
It's the hate and the resentment leaving their body and they're willing to help out.
Yeah. It's an interesting point. And I can't deny, like I can't say like, no, you didn't get that from this film. Because because that's what you got from this film. I think it's a fun creature feature.
Yeah,
with definitely. a little bit of light dusting of some social commentary.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Would you, however, like to play a game?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
It'd be good.
You ready for this?
I am.
I don't know if you are. This is this a real A24 film or have I made it up? There's two rounds.
Okay.
Okay. The first one's easy. I'm going to give you three plot synopses. Okay.
Yeah.
One of them is not an A24 film. Two of them are.
So one is fake.
One is fake.
Two are real.
Two are real. In the easy round.
Okay.
One is fake.
Okay.
So don't say until the end.
Okay. I got you.
Three synopses.
Yep.
A Welshman uses the phone driving down the road. Nothing else happens for 2 hours.
Got you.
A black man confronts racism whilst trying to withdraw a lottery win from the bank. A six-year-old girl lives with her mother in a motel in Florida.
Okay. I mean, Locke.
Yeah, it's the first one, right? Yeah. Okay. We covered it on the podcast. Go listen to that episode.
Go listen to it. It's Tom Hardy on the phone.
So now we switch the odds. We'll go down to two. Is it a black man confronting racism whilst trying to withdraw his lottery win from the bank?
Yeah.
Or a six-year-old girl living with her mum in a motel in Florida?
One's real, one's fake.
Yeah.
I can't think of what either film would be. I'm going to go lottery win.
Lottery win is...
real.
Is real. No, that's my made-up film called For Insecurity Purposes. And it would just be a black man who wins a lottery and tries to get his money out of the bank. I'd watch the shit out of that,
to be honest.
Right, they don't believe him that it's his money.
I would watch the shit out of that.
The real film stars Willem Dafoe. And it was all shot guerrilla style on like phones and about a little girl who lives in a motel opposite Disneyland. And her mum's super poor. They've got nothing to do, but she lives next to like the most magical place on earth. And it's nothing happens in the film.
So this is like if America did the Zone of Interest.
Yeah. Ben, what is going on today?
I've stopped caring.
I mean,
it's a joke.
That phrase is always said after the least controversial statements, isn't it?
it's the posthumous. I'm not racist, but.
Yeah, it's that. You know what I mean? It's the butt. If one comes before, the other comes after.
That's it. Yeah.
Right, you ready for hard round?
Hit me the hard round.
Okay. We got three.
Okay.
One of them is fake. Two of them are real.
Two of them are real. One is fake.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Ashy teenager befriends a rebellious alien.
Okay.
Oh, wait. A shy teenager befriends a rebellious alien.
What's happening? How are you, the dyslexic one, this time around?
I don't know what's happened. You brought research and tapestries, and now I can't read.
Okay.
A shy teenager befriends a rebellious alien.
Okay.
A prison therapist becomes obsessed with a serial rapist who's about to be released.
Okay.
French kickboxer Clement Augustin competes in a Malaysian Taekwondo tournament to escape a drug debt. Which is the fake?
I feel like the middle one's the fake.
A prison therapist becomes obsessed with a serial rapist who's about to be released.
I would watch the fuck out of it because it sounds insane.
Well, you can, because A24 released a film called Instinct, a French movie about exactly that.
Okay, that sounds amazing.
So now
you've
got
my watch list.
French kickboxer in a Taekwondo tournament escaping drug debt. Or a rebellious alien befriending a shy teenager?
I want number one to be true.
Well, good news, because it is. That's directed by John Cameron Mitchell, who plays Hedwig in Hedwig and the Angry Inch, based on a short story written by Neil Gaiman, starring Ellie Fanning and Nicole Kidman.
What's it called?
How to Talk to Girls at Parties.
Okay.
That's a real film.
That's fucking incredible.
Did not review well. Did not review well.
Bro, this game is great because it's just adding to my watch list.
I'm so fucking happy that one's real.
That.
Yeah. I want to watch it as well. John Cameron Mitchell is one of my cinematic gods. and can do no wrong in my eyes. So I'll watch it anyway, even if it is awful. I'm so well done. You won. 100%.
One-ish.
10 out of 10, mate.
Oh, I'm in.
What are you rating Death of a Unicorn?
Fat 10. This is my movie.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that I love B-movies is they're fucking amazing stories that don't have the budget that they deserve to be as big and as grand and as bold as they need to be.
Sure. Right?
To really sell. So you end up with these sort of like weird passion projects that have had like blood, sweat and tears poured into it for years on end.
Yeah.
However long, by countless people, and everyone is just willing to do what it takes to get it done. And I fucking love that scrappy underdog stuff, right? This has that tone and that storyline and that kind of the beats of a B movie with the big enough budget. I mean, admittedly, the CGI at some points
is diabolically
bad. Ropey. Yeah. It's weightless, considering there are enormous unicorns. Yeah. It is weightless, but
awful.
It still sells because of everyone that's involved in it. They still have this innate passion and love for every speck
that's
gone into this. And I adore that.
The CGI is enough to suspend disbelief and tell the story.
Exactly.
Like, exactly. The story gets told and the story is good enough that you don't really mind that it looks a bit ropey.
There are parts of the film. This is why I love If You Were the Last. You know, the Anthony Mackie movie that we did?
Great film.
Amazing film.
Excellently directed.
Excellently directed.
We spoke to that director.
We did. Go listen. That film's incredible because it has insane acting.
Mm-hmm.
Love, soul, heart pumping through it.
And papier-mâché effects.
And papier-mâché effects. But it's sold completely straight-faced. Yeah. And I love that. Mm. This is a me film through and through. Yeah. I fucking adore it. I will watch this again. It's one of those ones that stuck with me in a weird way.
Yep.
And okay. I can't explain why.
Fair.
Fat 10. How about you?
It's a 7.
Okay.
It's well made enough and enjoyable enough in the moment that it's more than a 6. I feel like once you're below a 4, you've fundamentally failed at some aspect of the filmmaking, right?
I think 4's a cut off. 4's a cut. Right. Anything above a 4 and it's
you've successfully made an film.
It's positive. Right. Yeah.
No. Not for me. I feel like above a 5. 4 is like...
I don't think you understand how maths work. Half of 10,
right,
4.
Right. For me, 4 is like, well done, you achieved an film.
Yeah.
It is bad. 5 is, I don't mind either way.
Right.
And 6 is like, it's just on the edge of, you know. Sure. So this isn't a 6.
Okay.
I feel it is ably made. It's funny. Will Poulter's a delight. Richard E. Grant, I'm always happy to see on screen.
God, I fucking love that guy.
The day that he's no longer with us will be a very sad day because I'm a massive With Nell and I fan. I think it's an ably made film.
Yeah.
I can't hate it because it is disposable. It's like napkins.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that a napkin is there when I need a napkin.
Okay.
I don't think about that napkin the next day. I've moved on.
Oh, but the napkin is always available and useful when needed.
Right.
I'll go with that analogy.
It's a 7.
Napkins are a 7.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Such a good analogy.
When you need a napkin, it's fucking great to have one there.
Yeah, it is.
But when you don't need a napkin, you're not thinking about them.
No, but now that I am thinking about them, incredibly useful.
There we go.
What a great little bit of paper.
There we go.
Absolutely savage nature for. Let's just rip down this tree and pat my tiny corner mouth I've got a bit of pizza
on it.
All right,
unicorn, turn your black
Death
off.
Of a unicorn speaks, buddy. Every situation, even the napkin analogy. Death of a fucking unicorn, buddy. This film is universal. It's fucking mint.
Oh, that's it. We are so over time.
This
is going to be an 85-minute episode on Patreon.
Yeah, enjoy it. Enjoy every second of it.
Oh, no, we'll have to cut some bits out.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
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 There's a lot of bits.
No, there's a lot of bits. I've got to get we're at, 80 minutes now.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get a quarter of this episode gone.
Yeah. A lot of it is Kevin Spacey.
A lot of it's Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
But because we called back to Kevin Spacey so many times.
You got to put it in.
I've got to keep it in.
Yeah.
So I don't know what I'm going to be able to take out.
That's not an
accident. I'm going to have to remove 25% of this episode and get it ready by 10 p.m. And I've still got to go to the tip and we've got to do socials.
And the surfer.
That's definitely not happening
now.
This is going to take me 4 hours, 5 hours to edit and I've got work to do and a tip run.
Nah. Guys, that's it. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. This is the end of the show, unfortunately.
Oh, sad
times. We love you all dearly. Thank you so fucking much for hanging with us. bottom of our hearts.
Bottom of our hearts.
Your support is insane. Thank you. Love you. Go tell your fucking friends about us.
Go tell your friends about us. Meanwhile, Ben is going to wrap up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of this week's episode into a little Monday motivational pep talk while I just tell you to consume.
Maybe don't be a Leopold. In life, don't be the maybe a bit of a Leopold is okay. Be Shepherd Leopold to a point before Griff. Be Griff. Be Griff, the guy that is Leopold adjacent but still knows what's right and wrong. But then when Elliot shows up, he's not overly good, but he does go and get the police. Be Griff. Griff is the one. Or be the unicorn, murder everyone, take the money.